Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda Fineman, and this is the Healthy Options program right here on WERU Community Radio. Today, for our annual discussion about ticks, Lyme disease, and other tick-borne diseases, we turn again to Dr. Beatrice Santier, pediatrician, internist, and very well-informed individual about Lyme disease and tick-borne illnesses. For more than two decades, Dr. Santier has lectured on Lyme disease and related tick-borne disorders throughout Maine and also nationally to both professional and community groups. She's an active member of the Vector-Borne Disease Working Group here in Maine at the CDC of Maine, as well as a member of the International Lyme Associated Disease Society. In 2022, Dr. Santier also served on the Federal Tick-Borne Disease Working Group, Access to Care, and Education Subcommittee. We want to welcome you back to Healthy Options, Dr. Beatrice Santier. So good to speak with you again. Here we are.
Thank you so much, Rhonda.
So we've done these programs in the fall, we've done these programs in the spring, and here we are in the spring this time, even though ticks are around all the time.
Yeah, things have changed. But it's been true for quite a while now. These ticks that we're most concerned with, the black-legged ticks, hard-bodied ticks, are active pretty much year-round. If the temperatures are above freezing, some will tell you it's got to be 37 degrees, but above freezing, they're active. And so we need to be concerned. There are cases of tick-associated diseases reported throughout the year.
But people think about it when it gets warmer, the sun's out, you're outside more, wearing less clothing, less protection. So what we want to do, and I think we the focus of this particular program is to really talk about what the co-infections are and to get a good sense of what's new here in Maine and nationally. So what are you seeing in the research these days?
Well, this is such an important topic now. And I think we know that the tick that carries Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, is well established in every county in Maine, except maybe Aroostook. It is, and what we mean by established is that there's the full life cycle of the tick present in the county and the disease. Of interest is that, of course, cases of Lyme disease and ticks reported from Aroostook are rising. So that's going to happen. But nationally and locally, CDC is turning its attention to the other infections or conditions that are being transmitted by ticks and the other ticks responsible for these things. So not just the black-legged tick, of which the university examined over 3,000 submissions last year, but also ticks like the Lone Star tick or Amblyomma americanum. They're interested in the longhorn tick, which has not yet been identified in Maine, but since it was first reported in New Jersey in 2017, it has spread all across the East Coast, at least from Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts, south. So, and we have isolated reports more north than that. But it's just the environment is a tick-friendly environment, and we have no reason to think that Maine will not be subject to these other ticks setting up shop here. So
what do these ticks carry? Is it just Lyme disease? And we hear about co-infections, and I know that people are getting tested and they're finding, and we'll talk about, and we are talking about how to find out if you are bitten by a tick, what is that tick carrying? We need to talk about all of that. So what are we seeing now that we weren't seeing before or we're seeing more of?
Great question. So the black-legged tick, the tick that does carry the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, is also carrying Anaplasma. I'll give you the whole name, but you know, no quiz on this at the end. Anaplasma phagocytophilum that causes anaplasmosis, also carrying Babesia microti that causes babesiosis. There may be, and we'll find out if there are other species of Babesia that are also being transmitted. That's an investigation that's on its way. There's another Borrelia called Miyamotoi. We used to call the disease it causes Borrelia Miyamotoi disease. It is now called hard tick relapsing fever. So that's being tracked. And very importantly, Powassan virus is transmitted by the same tick. And one of the, I think, startling features of Powassan virus for me is the rapidity with which it can be transmitted by a tick. It only takes 10 to 15 minutes of that tick's feeding attachment for this particular virus to be transmitted. It's a neurologic virus. It can be neurologically devastating. And there have been fatalities in the state of Maine from this virus, also elsewhere, but we'll focus on Maine today. So, and that's just our friendly Ixodes scapularis black-legged tick. You know, so if we get into the other ticks that are in the state, and we should, one of the most common ticks people encounter is the dog tick called Dermacentor variabilis. And that can carry rickettsia disease. Think Rocky Mountain spotted fever, though we have never had a homegrown case of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. To my knowledge, I think we've investigated for it. And we have found cases in the state, but usually they were associated with travel, so not necessarily local. Ehrlichia species, the bacteria that causes tularemia can be in those ticks. Heartland virus. So there are a number of human, important to human infections that can be carried. And then the Lone Star tick is something that we are tracking increasingly. There have been reports of Lone Star ticks for a number of years here, but until recently, most have been associated with travel, their presence here. People have been out of state. There are probably 19 cases now of Lone Star ticks being removed from people who have no travel history. And the importance of the Lone Star tick are the infections that it carries. But perhaps what people are hearing most about, and I'd like them to be aware of, is the possibility of a condition called alpha-gal syndrome. It's an allergy that's produced by a reaction to this sugar particle, galactose, alpha-1,3-galactose. Nicknamed alpha-gal, and it results in a red meat allergy. Most mammals, except primate types like us, have alpha-gal as part of their cellular makeup. We do not. And so exposure to alpha-gal in some people can result in allergy. Usually it's a delayed hypersensitivity response. So maybe hives, maybe trouble breathing, but also diarrhea, vomiting can be associated with it. And because it's not immediately after one eats some red meat, it can be missed for quite a while before people really figure out that it's related to what they've been eating. So a heightened awareness is important. And there was a recent paper. So we associate this with the Lone Star tick, Amblyomma americanum, and the folks who first identified it associated with that because of the distribution that was being found. Well, guess what? We know that around the world, there are other ticks that have caused this syndrome to occur. And there was a recent paper done on 23 cases of alpha-gal in Maine, and one case that is definitely associated with an Ixodes tick bite, so a black-legged tick bite. So can any tick bite cause this? Maybe. Now, I'm a simple thinker. If it were commonly caused by these more common ticks in the state of Maine, we'd expect to see a lot more of it than we do. So there must be something about the interaction with the Lone Star tick that makes it more efficient at causing this problem. One of the scary features of it is, although I told you about the delayed hypersensitivity reaction, people should also be aware that there can be an immediate kind of hypersensitivity reaction, and that can be associated with some medicines that are in relatively common use in medicine. Heparin, for example, has a moiety that is related to this alpha-gal. There are some chemotherapeutic drugs. So this condition has been identified when these medicines are used intravenously as an immediate hypersensitivity. So it really means that the general public and medical people need to be thinking about this and ask questions about potential tick exposures before starting most any important treatment. So lots going on.
Wow. So some of these, so we're talking about viruses, we're talking about bacteria, we're also talking about a parasite, which or which, and what you treat them all differently, wouldn't you? And how would you know?
Well, the good news is that anaplasma, which causes anaplasmosis,
which is a bacteria or a virus?
It's a bacteria. So it's, you ready? It's an obligate intracellular bacteria. I think of all of these as being parasites, by the way, but technically not. But obligate intracellular, and it lives in white blood cells. So the symptoms that it may cause, fever, flu-like symptoms, achiness, terrible, terrible headache. It can also show up with lowered white blood cell count, so decreased neutrophil population. Also can show up with decreased platelets, the part of your blood that helps to clot your blood. And it's kind of critical because in a vulnerable population, it has pretty immediate fatalities associated with it too. So here's the good news. It is treated by doxycycline, which is often the first line we use for Lyme disease. And the education we provide to healthcare providers is if you think it, you should treat it, because immediate intervention saves people. Doxycycline for Lyme disease is a great choice because it also treats anaplasma. For that matter, it also treats hard tick relapsing fever disease. So the good news is some antibiotics will do a lot of these. Powassan is a virus. Again, we have no treatment for that. Babesia, here's a fun one. It's in the category of microorganisms that are called pyroplasms. So this one is an obligate intracellular bacteria that lives in red blood cells. It's a malaria-like infector. And so I think malaria thoughts when I'm thinking about Babesia. So high fever, sweats, chills, air hunger, headache, all of these have that flu-like appearance, and that makes summer flu a particularly challenging diagnosis. We'd like to think that, you know, there are some giveaways on it, but you have to be thinking about what your tick exposures may have been so that you remember to report it to your inquiring healthcare provider when you show up sick. Babesia is not treated by the usual medicines we use to treat other tick-borne infections. It requires, well, in the olden days, it was clindamycin and quinine. But if you like the person you're treating, you might make a different choice because those medicines work, but they're very hard to tolerate. And so what is more commonly used is atovaquone and azithromycin. So good news, azithromycin has some activity against the others, but you will not get the reverse effect. You need to specifically target Babesia if you suspect it or have documented it. For Babesia and for anaplasma, one of the great ways to look for it is on a slide, on a blood slide. You can actually see these parasites inside either the red cell for Babesia or the white blood cells for anaplasma. And that's, you know, that's obviously perfect evidence. More common evidence that's obtained is probably PCR. We can do antibody.
What is PCR?
Oh, I'm sorry. PCR, polymerase chain reaction. It's looking for the DNA, the genetic makeup of these agents in blood samples. But, you know, PCR is fabulous when it's positive, because if it's positive, it's pretty surely an indicator that that microorganism is there. If it's negative, it's not as helpful. So you have to make sure that people are weighing and balancing the history, the physical exam, and using the laboratory as one of the data points, not the overriding data point. So important to know the limitations of the testing when you're doing it.
This is, by the way, if you just tuned in, this is the Healthy Options Program on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Fineman. We're speaking with Dr. Beatrice Santier about ticks and tick-borne diseases. And this is so important, getting back to that negative test. You can still have you could still have an infection, a tick bite, tick-borne illness, even if your test comes back negative.
That's true. Yeah, right. You know, we all really want our tests to be positive when we have something, and
negative when we don't.
Yeah, and that's it. It's really a balancing act. It's balancing sensitivity and specificity. And we do the same thing looking for Lyme disease, you know, Borrelia burgdorferi infection. Most of how we find that is still with antibody testing. It takes your body 2 to 8 weeks to mount a measurable antibody response. So if we test early, which nobody recommends, if you show up with the rash of Lyme disease, you should just be treated. But if you do test early, your body may not have had time to mount an antibody response that's measurable. If we test later in infection, it turns out that the antibody tests are a lot better if what you have is arthritis from this infection than if you have a neurologic complaint from the infection. I think the sensitivity for arthritis is full on 96%. The sensitivity for a neurologic infection is about 72%. So, and the sensitivity is the test's ability to pick up a positive infection if it's truly there. So you have to be cautious about the use. And then in individuals who have been treated for these infections, it's hard to know what to make of antibody testing, because we know that some people who are treated are completely well, and yet they may still have positive antibodies, while others may still be quite ill and the antibody response may have waned. And there, we could have a whole long talk about how that happens, but it's one data point, and people need to be mindful of that one data point.
I think at some point we will have a show dedicated to that exact conversation. But right now on this show, I want to talk about what we are talking about, which are the what we can see around the country, if you're traveling, if you're listening to this somewhere else, but also in Maine, and right. Also prevention, which we will get to. There are other things we talked about. You talked about Ehrlichia and alpha-gala. Yeah. Are there ways to treat those as well, or what are those?
Okay. Again, Ehrlichia is also an infection. Again, Ehrlichia is going to be an obligate intracellular white blood cell infector. It looks a lot like all of these others, very similar appearance, can lower platelets, can cause elevated liver functions. Not as common at all as these others. And in fact, for many years, I used the presence of Ehrlichia chaffeensis, which is a particular infector found in Lone Star ticks, as a little bit of an indicator of what was going on with the presence of Lone Star ticks in the state. But we treat them, doxycycline is wonderful for that. It's anaplasma-like And in fact, anaplasma used to be in categorized as an Ehrlichia, but it got moved to this other group because it's more genetically similar to that. So
similar symptoms, but different categories because it's on that cellular level, it looks different.
Yeah, it's exactly that.
Yes.
Alpha-gal is different. Alpha-gal is not an infection. It's an allergy, a true allergy. And it's an allergy to all red meat and red meat products. So people who have alpha-gal can have reactions not only to meat products, but also dairy products from all of these red meat animals. So cow, pig, goat, lamb, you can't eat any of them because they have this. So what is the treatment? At this time, the immediate treatment is how we would treat allergy, antihistamines, sometimes epinephrine if you're having difficulty breathing. So it's treating allergy. And going forward, so far, it's elimination. Now, there is a test for this. They have developed a test. It's really cool. The North Carolina crowd at Scott Common's lab has been all over this like white on rice, and they've done beautiful work. And so it can be tested for. You can, again, you have to know the limitations of the testing. If it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks, and has webbed feet, even in the, you know, with a negative test, it may still be a duck. So
it's a clinical diagnosis is what you're saying.
Everything is data points. Pull your data points in. So this particular condition responds to elimination in the diet. And some people have to eliminate all red meats and dairy and look, some people are so sensitive. You have to read the labels on some of the cosmetic products you might use to find out if gelatin is in it or other things that you don't think of as having red meat connection. So important to look at all of it, depending on the severity of the condition in the individual. Elimination has been found to be effective. So if you have this red meat allergy, you have to leave all of these things out of your diet and out of your exposure. Some people can eat ice cream. Some people can eat cheese. But pretty much everybody has to avoid red meat.
This is pretty much forever.
Happy news, does not appear to be so. So far, it looks like most people who have this exposure, after an extended elimination time, can begin to reintroduce some of these items and be okay, or can undergo a desensitization protocol, you know, small amounts gradually introduced over time with very careful watching. So it's looking like 24 months, so 17, 24. I'm sure for some individuals, it is a lifelong experience. I wonder for those if they have continued re-exposures. There does appear to be some relationship, though it's not clear how this works, but some relationship between frequency of known tick attachments. And folks who have this condition tend to report fairly frequent tick encounters. So this, like all of the other infection types that we talk about, really always come around to you got to keep ticks off of you.
Right.
You know, that's our best answer going forward still. No vaccine is going to fix this as such, unless it's the one that I'm waiting for, the vaccine directed against tick saliva so they just fall off somehow.
So we're about to get into that, but there are two things. There are some people who cannot take antibiotics. and they're allergic or something. And I do want to say that there are some homeopathic protocols that are quite comprehensive. They're really very specific and thoughtful. They're also herbal remedies. Yeah. So there are other ways to approach this, but you do need to do this with some care and thought.
I'm best acquainted with those as adjunctive treatments. I would so strongly encourage people with early disease to get all over it with an antibiotic if you can.
Exactly. If you have the rash, and not everybody gets a rash, that's what we have to talk about.
Yeah.
Then that's a way before the bacteria gets encapsulated, right? Before it's harder to attack. Would you say?
The longer it's around, the more things can happen. And this is we're talking Lyme disease right this minute.
Yes,
but,
right.
You know, the early intervention for anaplasma is just critical because it can be
life-threatening.
A really aggressive bad actor. And I always think, you know, in my mind, I think Rocky Mountain spotted fever, that's another one. If you think it, you treat it. You do not wait for testing to show up. So that's my rule of thumb. Lyme disease is a little different. It's generally not an immediately fatal illness. There have been fatalities. Some people have it impact their heart. And if you don't think it, you don't identify it. People can die from it. And there have been recent deaths. So it's important to have your awareness level high for where you've been, what you've been doing, and can you have been exposed to ticks? Most people who get Lyme disease do not recall a tick. They don't see it. These are tiny creatures. This time of year, we're right in May now, and so the most common encounter with a tick that transmits Borrelia is going to be with the nymphal stage of the tick, and that nymph is the size of a poppy seed. So when you get your bagel, when you have your everything bagel, I'm going to ruin them for you now. Take a look at it. You can see the poppy seeds on it. That's about the size of a nymphal tick. The sesame seeds are about the size of the adult black-legged tick. Once they engorge, of course, here's another food group I'll ruin for you. They can get to look like raisinettes, but mostly they're not, you know. So once they're engorged, though, it's very hard to distinguish one tick from another. But you have to have some awareness that they can be there. So if you're checking for ticks, you can't just look for them, because you can imagine how easy it would be to miss that tiniest freckle on your body. You have to look and feel everywhere, from head to toe, behind the knees, in the groin, at the waistband, the belly button, all over the torso, but in the armpits, behind the ears, on the scalp. You have to look and feel. And if you feel a bump, don't panic. Have somebody look. See if the bump has legs. If it has legs, you need to remove it carefully. Proper timely removal can save a world of hurt. So best is fine nose tweezers, grabbing the tick as close to the skin as you can and pulling with steady, gentle pressure straight out, and it comes out with a little bit of oomph. Don't give up. Just steady, gentle pressure straight out. Clean the bite site. Put the tick in a plastic bag for safekeeping in case you want to send it for evaluation. And wash your hands, wash your instrument. The other method that has been demonstrated to be proper removal is with a tick scoop, where it looks like a teaspoon measure with a V cut into the front of it. And you get that V wedged, as you know, pushed down on the skin, get as the mouth parts, if you can, wedged into that V and keep going straight across the tick bite. You should end up with a tick in your scoop. Same aftercare. Wash the site, wash your hands, wash your instruments, save the tick, because it's not so much that sending the tick is going to tell you what to do. that's not the case. But sending the tick does give us the amazing statistics that the tick lab is able to assemble for us at the Cooperative Extension.
That's in Maine.
In Maine, the University of Maine Cooperative Extension. Look up tick lab online and you'll get to there. You can then get their fabulous yearly report, which is so interesting and has so much information in it. But they will, for free, they will identify that tick and tell you how engorged or unengorged it is. If the tick has had the opportunity to feed at all, that makes it a risky encounter. If there's no feeding, I'd feel pretty safe about that. But that may not be the only tick that you've had on you. So it's all.
And you don't really know what that bite has already transmitted. Right. If powassan is in 15 minutes.
Right.
And right. Now, you can also get it tested for all of the co-infections that we've been talking about.
And
for a fee.
$20. And they test for Borrelia, Anaplasma, Babesia, hard tick relapsing fever, Myomotoi, and powassan virus. That is a bargain. Well, I know some days it's not, but that it's, they test for the important things that they're probably going to add to that. In fact, in the future, but I don't want to speak for Griffindill. He'll let you know what he's going to add. So,
if you've just joined us, this is the Healthy Options Program on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Feynman. We are speaking with Dr. Beatrice Antier about ticks and tick-borne diseases. So sending it in, tell that address again.
Oh,
for and there are also national places you can also send it to.
Yeah, you don't have to send it to the university. But it's
right here in Maine. If you are here, if you're listening to this nationally, there are other states do this, and also there are other labs. And if you're not having any symptoms, it doesn't mean that you don't have something. Does it show up, or does it? I mean, does it show up later? What about this? Yeah. The two doxy pills that we always talk about.
This is okay.
We have to mention it every time because
this is a very common approach to a tick bite that is considered risky. A risky tick bite is a black-legged tick bite, if there's any evidence of feeding. So not a perfectly flat tick.
Also, don't annoy the tick. We like to, when
if you the remove tick has it. Broken off, and so that allows the possibility of gut fluids getting into this wound. And we are notoriously poor humans at estimating how long a tick has been attached. And that's okay. That's not a criticism. It's just a fact. We're not good at it. So transmission times are very interesting to talk about. It used to be we thought Lyme could not be transmitted before 72 hours of attachment. And then we said, okay, well, maybe it's 48 hours and then maybe it's 36 hours. And now we're saying 24 hours. You know, there are articles from the early 2000s that showed tick transmitted Lyme disease within 14 hours of attachment. So what's the safe time? I don't know. We don't know. What we can say is that if you have a risky bite, and I would count it, you know, more than 12 hours of attachment. Many would say under 24 is okay for Lyme disease, that you should treat it. It's not zero at less than 24 hours. The rate of transmission is not zero, but it's low. And it just, you know, rises kind of exponentially over that 72-hour window, so that at 72 hours of attachment, if the tick is carrying the bacteria, it is very likely to have been able to transmit it. So that's longer is worse. That doesn't account for partially fed ticks who may already have the bacteria in their salivary glands. You know, when the tick starts to feed, it's such a special organism. They're very efficient. They're very good at what they do. When I start to feed, this bacteria is generally located in the midgut as they feed, the bacteria multiply, get back into the circulation, and make their way to the salivary glands. And the tick feeds by sucking a little, spitting a little. I'm sorry. Did everybody already have lunch? I'm still sorry. Suck a little, spit a little, and gradually can transmit a bolus of this infector if it's carrying it. But if by chance that infection is already in the salivary glands because this was a tick who partially fed on some other guy, then that whole process is speeded up. Can you know how long that? No, you can't know it. And Lily Bergdorfer says 2 to 5% have it already in the salivary glands. Lily Bergdorfer of blessed memory now, but I believe him. He did a lot of work on this, and you just have to be aware that none of this information is for sure in this one case that you're experiencing yourself. This is generally what we know. So to get to prophylactic antibiotics, and by that, prevention comes in a few stages. There's the real base of this pyramid is keeping ticks off, and we'll get to that. The next step is removing them early. And the third step is antibiotic prophylaxis. A commonly used method in emergency rooms and urgent care and many, many physician offices is to give a single dose of doxycycline, 200 milligrams, within 72 hours of tick attachment. That is the recommendation that's in the Infectious Disease Society of America's guidelines. And has been well received, and why not? We want to do something. It's based on a
why not?
Why not? There is a good reason why not.
There is a good reason why not.
Yeah, unfortunately, and it was shown within the study that is used to support this, the one study that's used to support this that was done in the U.S. and we can't use European studies in the U.S. for these things. Different tick. Different species of Borrelia causing disease. And frankly, the Borrelia that is most common in the U.S. is more likely to spread throughout the body than the most common Borrelia in Europe.
Wow.
So they have three different Borrelia, and the most common one is unlikely to spread. So we can't compare it very well, and we shouldn't. So two pills, two doxycycline, given early may prevent the development of Lyme disease. The study itself reported out an 87% efficacy of this approach.
One study.
And really on reanalysis, you do the best you can with the study. You set it up in a way, they're not trying to get a bad answer. They're trying to get a good answer. But reanalyses have suggested that they might have overestimated how effective it is, and it may be more like 50%. Now, I'd be really impressed with 50%, honestly. I mean, one dose of antibiotic, and there were reasons they thought it might work, and I don't think those reasons apply, but there were reasons they thought it might work. Anyhow, the problem with it, what's the problem with it? If we give antibiotics early to this infector, it can turn off your body's antibody response to this bacteria, even if you remain infected. So now 6 weeks later, when you show up sick, you may have a negative Lyme test and be dismissed as, well, you can't have that because your test is negative. We're back to the single data point. If you have a clinical syndrome of symptoms consistent with Lyme disease, a known history of tick bite, I think despite a negative test, we should be considering that this could indeed be Lyme disease anyways. So as long as a provider is your provider and is going to follow you through, and if you show up sick, is aware that we may have turned off the antibody response with the early antibiotic, okay, that's not so bad. But I think it's not a good idea. I think if we're going to treat, we need to treat with more antibiotic than just the single dose. There, do I have good data to support that? No. But I do have a little data to support it. And there were three studies done even a little earlier than that study. And the infection rate in ticks is much higher now than it was for any of those studies. There were three studies done using 10 days of antibiotics in all age groups, and they followed patients for at least a year after this event. And what the findings were is that no one who received the antibiotics for 10 days developed Lyme disease. And people who didn't receive the antibiotic for 10 days, some did. None of these studies reached statistical significance. So technically, you can't use them to validate 10 days. So is it 10 days? Is it 5 days? Is it 20 days?
21 days.
We simply don't know. We do know that in mice, an antibiotic, doxycycline specifically, that's active for 19 days is 100% effective at preventing infection in mice. And interestingly, not only 100% effective against Borrelia burgdorferi, but also 100% effective against Anaplasma. We have no human studies of preventing Anaplasma. We have no human studies preventing Babesia. We have no human studies about preventing Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We don't know. There's a lot we don't know. So you have to use your best judgment and surmise. I'd love to see folks try to do these studies now with the infection rate in ticks that's out there now. In Maine, I guess on average for Lyme, 41.5% are infected. 41.5% of ticks are in Ixodes scapularis ticks submitted to the tick lab at the university were infected. Now, it was 45% of adults. So nymphal ticks are a little less likely to carry infection, but a little more likely to transmit the infection because they're so small and are easily missed.
So we're still saying that the two doses, probably not the three weeks,
okay.
Maybe.
Well,
we don't know.
We don't know. We don't know.
But if you have a rash and if you have a clinical diagnosis, I would say...
If you have the rash of Lyme disease, you have Lyme disease. And that requires full treatment.
Weeks, and that's 3 weeks or more or less?
A lot of people want to treat with less than 3 weeks, but there's not good data to support that. There are articles that say it. The data is not good to support it. The best data was from early studies that were done and compared, and 3 weeks of doxycycline was superior.
Okay.
And if you are not perfectly well at the end of that treatment, another finding in the early studies was that your immediate retreatment with 3 weeks more brought resolution.
And so, you can have illness a year later? 2 years later?
There are two categories of that. But yeah, what early information showed that there can be a delay in onset of illness for people that can be weeks, months, or even years with this. And that, you can imagine, is a huge challenge because you may have no recollection of tick exposure long ago. So figuring out a neurologic problem that shows up years later can be really a challenge. The other way in which that happens, of course, is what I call persistent illness after treatment for Lyme. And there are probably a number of mechanisms for that. One of those mechanisms is persistent infection, and that has been documented in the literature. It may be that you're having a persistent inflammatory response to the infection. Your inflammatory system gets turned on and doesn't get turned off. You may have one of the other infectors that travels in the same ticks that has not been identified and treated, like, for example, babesiosis, which interestingly, when they travel together, babesia and borrelia, when a person has both infections, they tend to be sicker, the disease tends to last longer and be harder to treat.
So, and that is the malaria-like.
The malaria-like parasite.
If you've just tuned in, this is the Healthy Options Program on WERU Community Radio. I'm Rhonda Fineman. We're speaking with Dr. Beatrice Santier about ticks and tick-borne disease. So we did go, if you've just tuned in, at the beginning of the program, we did talk about all of the varieties of infection, or many of the varieties. So you might want to check that out as we're discussing treatment here at the end of the show. But I do want to talk about prevention, because if you're scared enough, now's the moment. This is what you can do about it. The basic thing is not to get a tick on you. So please.
And so important, the university's annual report, the Tick Lab annual report, is pretty clear, at least in the ticks submitted to the lab, 68% of people got their tick on their own property. So, this is a think about it at home and doing what activities, yard work, gardening, clearing brush. That is, I can't tell you how often I've seen that. So you have to be aware what you're doing and where you're doing it. So where do these ticks particularly, we're going to talk specifically about the Ixodes scapularis, where they hide out.
That's
they
the like black-legged.
Black-legged tick, commonly known as the deer tick. So it likes brushy areas. It likes tall grass. So it will be on the tip of whatever vegetation you're going through. If you're walking through grass that is ankle high, the tick is at your ankle height. If you're walking through vegetation that's elbow high, it's at your elbow. So you need to be aware of where you are and what you're doing. It needs moisture. So there are some property things you can do to diminish the likelihood of having these ticks on your property. Moisture is kept in the property by leaf litter or by low-growing vegetation like barberry or, Japanese barberry. Invasive species are not good for us with ticks. So whatever invasive species you can clear from your property, it's a good idea. If you have a lawn, I encourage you to keep it mown. After May, keep it mown short. And during May, be very careful when you're out there. Mown short, let it dry out. It's called xeriscaping, X-E-R-O, scaping. Landscaping for dry property, at least in the common use areas. If you feed birds, you should not put the bird feeder near the swing set, because birds are mass transit for ticks. And this time of year, it starts to increase. It's been suggested we can safely feed birds from October through April. But as the visitors from the south start traveling back north, it becomes a little less safe because ticks do travel on birds. Birds can be hosts for these bacteria, and you just don't want them falling off in your yard if you can help it. If you have deer who come to your yard, there are ways to make it less friendly. Deer fencing actually has some effect. Planting vegetation in the periphery of your yard that is deer unfriendly and untasty is a good idea. And for those who have a tick problem, or there are counties in Maine where everybody sprays and there are counties where nobody sprays, but spraying actually works. We talk about integrated pest management as being the best approach to dealing with this problem. And it is. It is the best approach, certainly for reducing ticks. The sad truth is reducing ticks has not yet on a property has not yet been demonstrated to reduce the incidence of Lyme disease. And part of that probably is that you may do all these things, do a perimeter spray twice a year, but your neighbor might not. So it's not perfect.
What are we spraying and how are we affecting the birds? It's a very tricky thing.
It's complicated. There is there was a very elegant study. I'm actually in the process of updating my property and prevention materials, so I haven't finished that. So you get the in-process information. But Metarhizium anisopulae is a fungus, and it actually is naturally occurring in the soil, but there are sprays of this that work as perimeter sprays in association with bait boxes for rodents. So rodents are part of the process, deer are part of the process, and ticks are part of the process, birds, yeah. But the fungal spray associated with well-placed bait boxes using fipronil for controlling ticks on mice is an effective approach, and I think a huge decrease in the number of ticks.
So let's talk about what to wear, what not to wear. Oh. Yeah, okay. This is really important. People go hiking and you're wearing, you're going out on your hike. It's 90 degrees out. You know, what are we doing? What should we be wearing? We're gardening. Well, if people, I've already seen clients this in the last 3 weeks. I was out gardening. I'm doing, and I have this. So let's talk about that. And we only really have important. About 4 minutes left. So
I will fly through this. Okay, so personal protection is also an integrated approach. You have to do several things. No one thing is a perfect solution. What we know is that permethrin-treated clothing is very effective, 73 times fewer ticks. And one study was done showing that if you spray your sneakers and socks, if you're wearing shorts, similar reduction in the number of ticks attached. So they looked at summer clothing, and you can, especially if you use that in association with repellents. And I recommend using EPA registered repellents. DEET remains the gold standard, 23% to 50%.
Ouch. For a lot of people.
Well, I know, but I'm telling you, this is the truth. We have, almost 70 years of safety and efficacy data on DEET. And the problem times, there is idiopathic. Some people have a reaction, can't predict that. But in general, if you use a lower concentration, and I mean at least 23%, not higher than 50%, lower concentration, you really don't need more than 30%. You're not getting better effect beyond that. So you've got this range. Apply it and wash it off after the use. All of these things are chemicals. I don't care if you're using biologics. I don't care if you're using natural oils. They're all chemicals.
Lemon eucalyptus.
Yeah, oil of lemon eucalyptus is documented to be effective. You probably have to apply it more often than these others. The EPA has a fabulous website. I'm pretty sure we posted. Oh, good point. Well, they used to have this fabulous website that you could go to, and we'll list it just in case it's still operating. But it talks about how long you want to be out there, what product you might be interested in using. So DEET, 23% to 50%, wash it off after the use. The trouble has been found in frequent high-dose applications without removing it in between. Picaridin is lovely at about, all of these should be about 20%, basically. So think 20% in your mind, at least. Picaridin is, it's derived from something kind of natural, but it's a manufactured product, as effective as DEET, probably better tolerated by individuals with chemical sensitivities, less fragrance, though you can get DEET unscented, by the way, so you can do that. Good on skin. The third one, IR3535, used to be just in Avon Skin So Soft Expedition formula. In many things now, it was studied at 15%, usually available at 20%. Think 20%. And PMD and oil of lemon eucalyptus, 20%. They are naturally derived. The others that are naturally derived, 2-undecanone. It's a tomato, wild tomato derivative. That's been studied. It's good. And I still haven't seen available commercially Newt Ketone. but it's coming. It's in citrus skin and in Alaskan yellow cedar. They're working on making that available. So use repellents on the skin, avoid the face, avoid the backs of your hands. You can see ticks on the backs of your hands, you know, don't want to rub your eyes.
Permethrin is on your clothing.
Permethrin is clothes, not useful on skin. And once it dries into the clothing, if you treat your own, once it dries in, it is inert in terms of being effective on other creatures like cats who do not have an enzyme to break it down. Okay. So it's bad for cats.
And do tons of tick checks.
When you come in, what's been demonstrated to be most effective, shower within 2 hours of an outdoor activity, look and feel everywhere. If you find a new bump, take it off, save it, send it to the tick lab because we like them. University at Amherst, UMass Amherst has a tick lab. I think they call theirs Tick Report now. They do evaluation. Anyway, you can do it.
Yes. Anything else? We're good.
I think that's as much as we can get into this time slot.
Okay, I'm hearing that the tick checks. Just touch
tick
everywhere. Check everywhere. Make sure that you are, what do you do? I come in, take my clothes off after a hike and put them in a bag
throw them in the dryer.
Shower.
Well, oh, yeah. Throw them in the dryer. High heat, 10 minutes, kills ticks. If you wash them first, it takes 50 minutes to kill ticks on high heat. So there are things we can do, and we need to do them. And we have to check our pets because, A, they can get Lyme too. But, you know, we often use excellent meds to keep ticks off of our pets. Unfortunately, they can still get on and fall off and then be your problem as the next feed.
The dogs and cats, obviously check your dogs and cats as well.
Your animals can get Lyme, dogs can get Lyme, cats can get Lyme, pretty uncommon.
I can't believe we're done, but there's so much more to say. Our guest today on Healthy Options has been Dr. Beatrice Santier. Thank you for being with us again on Healthy Options. It's always so good to talk with you. You can find links to the show and to other information that was mentioned, as well as all of our previous interviews with Dr. Santier, in the Healthy Options archives of the Public Affairs section at weru.org. Also get the WERU app and find Healthy Options there. Thanks to Joel Mann and Amy Brown for WERU at WERU for engineering support, Petra Hall for co-producing, and as always, thanks to all of our WERU listeners and supporters. This is Rhonda Fineman wishing you the best in health.